this is what it's like to be an artist today.
So I set them to train overnight. So I'll like hit go and then wake up in the middle of the morning. And it's like being a kid at Christmas when you like run and you turn on the computer and you're like, is it going to work?
Welcome to a world where artificial intelligence creates art.
This kind of like algorithm is producing an image using pieces of all of the knowledge that it knows.
This is Fixed That For You, an original podcast from Segment about solving problems with data and algorithms. I'm Cara Santamaria. In this episode, Anna Riddler takes a massive data set and tries to turn that into a work of art.
I had no idea what it would produce.
It's the story of a young new artist establishing her voice in the face of long-held traditions.
I think this idea of drawing and painting being a human thing will lessen.
In 2003, Anna Riddler was a teenager living in England.
I was really interested in painting and kind of representation in a very kind of realistic way. It was quite traditional, that kind of like how paint works and how drawing works.
She went to art school to pursue her dream, but it wasn't quite what she expected.
Because I was so young, and I think you're putting yourself out in the world and you're saying, this is what I believe. And I think good art is kind of like a little bit contentious. And when you're 18 or 19 or 20, I think the type of person I was very shy. I didn't really know what my position on a lot of things were. So I found like this thought of going to art school and having to do all of this quite scary.
What Anna's talking about is finding her voice. It's impossible for an artist to share their message with the world if they don't know what that message is yet. So, intimidated, she left art school, got a degree in English Lit, and this led to a series of administrative office jobs. But she still found ways to be creative.
One of the things that I got quite interested in was actually through using Excel and being able to kind of like mechanize things and be able to mechanize processes. You know, you don't have to do these like very long, boring things. You can kind of create a little mini algorithm.
After learning Excel, Anna took some basic coding courses.
To begin with, I was just doing really simple JavaScript stuff. As soon as I started using Python, then I could start kind of like making things.
Coding became her hobby and then her passion.
The idea of data and what data is didn't really exist for me when I was both an art student and at university studying literature. It was just kind of the idea that, you know, you can break the world up into tiny pieces and then use those tiny pieces to then maybe reveal bigger, wider themes.
And it started to change the way she saw the world.
When you code for sustained periods of time, you become, I suppose, hypersensitive to precision of things. And so in a way, it is like anti-poetry, because in poetry, you're trying to build in as many possible meanings to like one word. Whereas in code, you're trying to like strip out any ambiguity. So it's kind of like I have these two battling sides of my personality.
There it is, 200,000. Edmond, you in or out? I have 200,000, front left there, it's your bid, sir. At 200,000.
Around the same time Anna was undergoing this personal technological transformation, something similar was happening to the art world. The introduction of a subset of artificial intelligence. Something called a GAN.
GAN stands for a generative adversarial network.
That's Karen Howe. She writes about artificial intelligence for the MIT Technology Review.
It is referring to two neural networks that are actually competing with each other.
Neural networks are computer systems modeled after the human brain. They can learn.
They are able to do some pretty sophisticated math to transform data from like one thing to another.
And if you pit two neural networks against each other, this is what happens.
One neural network is called the generator, and it is in charge of creating whatever you're asking it to create. Like, let's say you're trying to generate dog images. So the generator starts by training on all these dog images and then creating a dog.
Based on the data set you give it, the generator will compose its own image of a dog.
And then the other network is called a discriminator, and the discriminator will then look at the dogs that the generator created, and based on the same set of training data, it will determine whether or not it's a dog. And anytime the discriminator says, this is not a dog, the generator has to go back to the drawing board and try again. these two networks will compete back and forth until neither of them can really outwit one another anymore. And at that point, you get a pretty darn good picture of a dog. And that's why if you are an artist and you're working with GANs, you can start creating pretty hyper-realistic images of whatever you want, whether that's a photorealistic picture of a dog or an artistic rendering of like a Van Gogh image.
That's an important point. The GAN will create images of real dogs or of Van Gogh-style paintings, depending on what you put in your dataset. When it comes to AI art, the composition of the dataset's everything. And that's especially true now that it's starting to sell at auction.
Of course, ahead of you. And selling for $480,000 then.
In October 2018, an original painting created by a GAN was sold at Christie's for more than $400,000. It was the work of three French artists that operate under the name Obvious. They selected 15,000 portraits from the 14th and 20th centuries, fed them into an algorithm, and voila. This amplified an ongoing debate in the art world about the role of technology. Can machines do something inherently viewed as a human skill? And even if they can, should we call it art?
Yes, it is a human quality. But ever since technology has existed, people have been trying to use this technology to push what drawing and painting means. Even when you're looking at the Renaissance, people were using technologies like lenses and things like that to push how they draw and how they painted. You're just starting to get to the point where machines are able to produce drawings that could be seen, and in fact have been seen, as being better than those produced by humans. And I think what's interesting is how you can kind of like not see that as a threat and how you can kind of embrace it and then use it as a way of pushing practices.
After leaving art school without the confidence to express a vision, Anna decided to return to art with conviction on the less popular side of a growing debate.
Rather than just kind of like thinking about art in a very kind of paint, pencil, canvas, paper kind of way.
She wanted to experiment with GANs and AI-generated art. But in doing so, Anna also wanted to distance herself from some of the other artists using machines, especially those who were using existing image banks.
That's fine, but it depends what you're trying to do with your work, and it depends what things you're interested in exploring. I'm not interested in kind of like taking the world as it exists.
Anna didn't want to explore someone else's data set, but the one she would come to need would be huge. Anna found GAN algorithms on GitHub and modified them to her specific needs. She experimented with a couple of small projects, then she was ready for a more complex one, something that would firmly establish her artistic voice.
I decided that I would use a GAN to create a tulip that would then respond to the price of Bitcoin.
Take your eyes off the screens, don't you, for the weekend, and you get another 13% bump higher in the price of Bitcoin.
So we've been talking about the rise of Bitcoin, but Thursday's action was out of this world.
Late in 2017, Bitcoin went crazy. It bounced up and down from over $22,000 to just $6,000. Anna saw similarities between the cryptocurrency bubble and a tulip craze that overwhelmed Holland in the 17th century.
A tulip bulb at that time, at the height of the bubble, went for the same price as an Amsterdam townhouse. And so I was really interested in how you can combine these two kind of moments in history. And I wanted to do that using AI and machine learning, which is going through its own bubble at the moment.
It was a way to explore technology while honoring her artistic roots.
I wanted to create something that referenced like old Dutch still lives. So, you know, the still lives which have like the beautiful flowers and the black background, so that when you would look at it, it would look like a tulip, but it would be constructed by an AI.
For that, Anna needed a data set of tulips. Thousands of tulips. The easiest way would be to do the same thing the French artists Obvious did, an online image search.
You have access to every image possible, but only if it's been tagged in the right way, or only if it is kind of like coming up with the keyword search that you say. And there are so many problems.
Not the least of which is bias.
Some of the biggest, most popular open source image sets were compiled at a time when the majority of images on the internet came from the US or from Western countries.
That's Karen Howe from MIT Technology Review again.
And so a lot of image recognition systems fail to recognize images that are not the standard Western image. So an example, if you show an image recognition system trained on this data set a picture of a Western bride wearing a classic Western white dress, then it'll say bride. But if you show it an Indian bride wearing a classic traditional sari, it'll just say woman. Because a lot of people are using the same exact image data sets, whatever bias that data set has been trickling into all image generation, image recognition systems. If you want to do something very specific with your artwork and you want to express something very specific, then the best way is to just do it yourself.
When I make a data set, I want it to reflect my worldview. I am building the world from the ground up so that if it's making mistakes or repeating biases or showing or creating a world, it's my biases and my world, and I can live with that.
For the Tulip Project, Anna's concerns weren't so much about bias as quantity.
If you Google tulip black background, you will not get 10,000 different tulips on a black background. That just doesn't exist. So that was something that I had to make and I had to do.
So she set out to build the world's largest tulip database.
If you decide to take 10,000 photos of tulips, you need lots and lots of tulips. So I went to the Netherlands and I would go to the flower markets and buy hundreds and hundreds of tulips.
Which earned her quite the reputation around Amsterdam.
The first time I went, I think they thought I was getting married. And then I came like every single Saturday for the next month. And I think they just thought I was the crazy English lady.
There were no shortcuts for this. The dataset had to be built one flower at a time.
So you have to take the tulip, strip all the leaves off, hold it, photograph it.
But the dataset she built wasn't random. It reflected her own artistic vision.
You kind of notice you need to buy more pink ones, or you need to buy ones that look a certain way, because you're getting too much of one color in your dataset by going to the same markets all the time. So I'd have to go to different markets to try and get different types of tulips.
At the time of the craze, striped tulips were the most valuable. So Anna's idea was that as the price of Bitcoin rose, the tulips in her art would get more stripes.
I needed to have enough stripy tulips that it would be able to learn what a stripe was. And stripy tulips are actually really difficult to find because they're valuable, they're rare, they're not as common as like normal tulips. So I was running around the Netherlands, just buying as many stripy tulips as I could find.
Week after week, she shopped, pruned, and photographed. But even after taking 10,000 tulip photos, she still didn't have a data set.
I have all of these photographs, but to an algorithm, it doesn't know what a tulip is. It doesn't know what color it is. It doesn't know what a stripe is. It doesn't know whether it's a bud or dead. To it, it's just kind of like, it's just maths. So I had to go and then hand label each of the photographs to tell so that it would be able to understand what was in that photograph.
This was the second time Anna's own bias impacted the data.
You'll have something that is pale, very pale pink, and you're like, is it pale pink or is it white? Is it yellow or is it orange? Is it pink or is it red? And as soon as you're confronted by putting something into a binary bucket, it suddenly becomes very difficult. And this is just for something as easy as the color of a flower.
It took Anna 6 exhausting weeks to label the flowers. And then she finally had something to feed into the adversarial network. But then, more problems.
So I finally have my data set, and then I start to run it. And the first time I run it, it doesn't work. It just doesn't. It just produced just green objects. Oh, I just cried. It was just horrible. Because also, I've just spent like months making this data set, and I knew I was having to exhibit it, so it had to work.
She rewrote a few sections of the code and tweaked the color variables. Then she gave the data back to both the generator and the discriminator to start creating tulips.
It was really, really hard to condition it, to get it to understand what a stripe was, because some of the time it would just not produce anything. And like, so you were having to test whether it could understand this idea of conditioning by doing it by color, and then kind of then adding an extra layer of kind of stripiness to see if it would understand. And then sometimes it would get really blurry, and sometimes that would mean I'd mislabeled my data.
It's kind of like teaching a child to draw. You give them an example to follow, but encourage them to be creative. When they stray too far from the objective, you alter the instructions to bring them back in line.
I ended up making probably about 30 to 40 different models to try and make it work.
This isn't something you can run on a laptop. The processing power required is massive and expensive, so Anna had to use cloud-based computing. She was making progress, but then she came up against another major obstacle.
There's something called mode collapse, which happens, which is when it overlearns or it kind of like underlearns and it just produces mush.
Mode collapse. It's a recurring problem for anyone training a neural network. It's a case of too much feedback from the discriminator. Going back to that analogy of the child, it's like they get really good at stick figures, and they get so much positive feedback, they just keep drawing the exact same picture over and over again. It can also go the other direction, when the young artist gets too much criticism, and they give up trying and just start scribbling. But Anna considered mode collapse part of her art.
It's something called the learning rate. So you can kind of see how well something is training, like how well it's understanding. It gets better and better and better, and then it will suddenly collapse. And that echoes the subject matter. So that's kind of like how the stock market works during these kind of speculative bubbles. It goes up and up and up, and then will crash.
But unlike the stock market, Anna finally got past mode collapse by tweaking the algorithm and the data set again. On her final attempt, she set the GAN to train overnight.
Is it gonna work? Has it worked this time?
She woke up the next morning, not sure what would happen.
It starts off with like nothingness, and you kind of like hit the space bar to see it progressing, to see it learning, and you kind of see it kind of going, you see these tulips forming from being really, really blocky, and then you keep on going and it's trained more, and then they start to become real looking tulips with stripes, and then you're like, oh my God, this might actually work. And then you see it and they become more and more defined and more tulip looking. And then you realize that it has actually worked and it's amazing. Yeah, so I was just so happy.
The algorithm was actually drawing unique pictures of tulips on its own.
Because I have such an intimate knowledge of the data set. Like, I can tell that it's made tulips that don't exist in the data set, but could be real tulips, which is really, really lovely.
At the same time, Anna thinks the GAN was following the same process as the Dutch masters when they painted still life.
They wouldn't just kind of like have a bunch of flowers in front of them and paint from it, because if you look at those paintings, there are flowers from winter and spring and summer and autumn all in the same bouquet of flowers. So rather than kind of like painting flowers that in front of them, they would kind of use all of the flowers that they know in their mind and paint. So they're painting from their imagination and memory rather than painting from what's in front of them, which is exactly the same way that this AI is working.
But there's one thing the Dutch masters probably wouldn't have added to their paintings.
Then you start to make it dream.
Yeah, they didn't have Bitcoin back then.
So there's a separate kind of script that you run, which adds in the price of Bitcoin, and then it starts to morph and change according to that.
The work's called Mosaic Virus. What you see is a grid of 48 different tulips against a black background, and they're constantly morphing, from buds to full bloom, and shifting colors from plain to striped. Each flower develops in its own way, but as a whole, the collection flourishes as the price of Bitcoin goes up and diminishes as the price falls. But as impressive as the final product was, Anna was still thinking about the dataset used to create it.
For me, this is such a huge important part of the project that now I display the database as its own separate work. And the reason why I chose to do that is because I think people don't understand what is in a dataset. This is a huge amount of information.
Mosaic Virus and its dataset were unveiled to great interest at the Impact Festival in Holland. But as with other pieces, it contributed to the debate over AI's place in the art world. You and I might have different opinions about whether a cubist Picasso is innovative or just a jumbled up face, but we all agree on where the credit lies. When art's produced by a GAN, it's legitimate to ask, was it the artist or the algorithm?
there is like a sliding scale. You have people who are just clicking and downloading a data set that already exists and clicking and downloading an algorithm that already exists and putting them together and then just pressing a button. On the other end, you have people like me and other artists who are really like considering about what they're trying to do and how this is then reflected in the whole process that they're making. And there is a huge amount of labor and there is a huge amount of time that goes into it. And I think that is what makes it art and not just like a cool tech demo. For me, I found it a really kind of liberating way of kind of exploring kind of like how I process the world and what I make of the world.
If you want to see Anna Riddler's Mosaic Virus, check out the show notes. That's it for this episode of Fixed That For You, a podcast by Segment about solving problems with data and algorithms. You can find us at segment.com/podcast, plus subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you do that sort of thing. We drop a new episode every 2 weeks. I'm Cara Santa Maria. Thanks for listening.